the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. This is Wednesday, April 16, 2003, and we're holding the hearing today on public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Senior and People with Disabilities. Couple of items. Both Representative Bates and Westland have been excused. They're busy meeting with the legislative council trying to come up with a draft document for to deal with the Oregon Health Plan. And then Representative Tootie Smith had the unfortunate, I think it's unfortunate when you have to go to the dentist. And so she's she's excused for medical and dental reasons today. Probably some of the other members are still probably having their lunch. As I stated yesterday, we've gotten so in this building now, we will be getting to be later and later coming out of floor sessions. And so with that, my members will tend to kind of straggle in. I just wanted the individuals in the audience to know that it's not because they don't want to be here. It's because often they're either testifying on other bills of theirs or they've had some other reasons that they couldn't. With that, we will continue where we left off yesterday, and my apologies for not being here all the way through your hearings yesterday, but I, too, was off in other parts of this building doing other kinds of activities. Housekeeping item, if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, would you please turn it off so that you don't disrupt the proceedings. We have with us today our favorite individuals, and that's Rosie and Rosette. They are both here to make sure that you feed them, and the feeding criteria is the use of acronyms or the alphabet soup. On the one hand, we try to discourage it, and on the other hand, we're very grateful when one of our individuals who are testifying use the acronyms, because the dollars that are going into Rosie and Rosette will, at the end of session, will go to the Oregon Food Bank. So with that, we're open. Mr. Naughton, do you have anything that you need to say before we begin?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Britton.
I don't.
You don't.
We have handed out yesterday the testimony for day one, and after Mr. Naughton completes the discussion of the governor's budget, I think Mr. Taves is going to continue with that. We also have day two, and I expect Mr. Taves and others to continue with that. So
are you on first, Mr. Naughton?
Madam Chair, I believe that I am the one kicking off this afternoon. I'm going to be working, or for the record, I am George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services. This is the document that I'm going to be working off of, and I will have plenty of opportunities to pay into Rosie today, because this is a very complicated budget with a lot of acronyms, and I am sure that I will slip into them here and there. More than any other budget within the department, as it's being brought forward to the Legislative Assembly this time, this cluster has more what I refer to as budget noise than anything else. There's a lot of transfers back and forth within this cluster that really have nothing to do with the underlying program. Many of you on this group are aware of the Medicaid upper payment limit, which is a financing mechanism that allows the state to capture a significant amount of federal funds. This is the originating cluster where all of those transactions happen. So you will see a lot of adjustments throughout this budget where the number either goes up or down $200 to $300 million, depending on whether or not those Medicaid upper payment limit funds are in the budget or phased out or increased or whatever happens. So before we get into this, I just want to mention for you that there's a lot of budget noise in this budget. The second thing I'll mention right at the beginning, and I will probably mention throughout my testimony, is that this cluster has had significant changes to it after it was published. So, for example, there are cuts included in this budget that in December we thought were workable. After we've worked through with the federal government, we found out that we cannot take the cuts that were in the governor's budget. And what was actually proposed ultimately with ballot measure 28 failing is something completely different than what you will see presented here today. This will be trued up when we get the reshoot budget in front of this committee, which will be another week or two before we get to that point. With that, let me move to page two, which is the overall pie, or the other overall table. And the big things that you'll notice there is that we had a significant increase in general fund and total fund expenditures through the fifth special session. You'll see that the general fund increased about $80 million and the total fund increased over $300 million. That is almost exclusively the addition of Medicaid upper payment limit transactions and that being folded into this budget. Then you'll see a significant drop in the governor's budget. The primary reason for that, well, two reasons. It's a combination of eliminating that same Medicaid upper payment limit financing and also the level of programmatic reductions that you'll see discussed later on. So I will try and highlight for you as we walk more through this document, but just on this first blush to see that there are some very dramatic ups and downs with this one. And again, I will attribute most of that to that budget noise that I talked about originally. On page three, you will see that 35% of this budget is made up of general funds, 57% is federal funds, primarily Medicaid under the Medicaid waivers that we have. Page four talks about what the ultimate changes are in this budget, and you'll see there's a 14.3% decrease from the legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. There is a $85.3 million general fund increase, but $67.7 million of that 85 is Medicaid upper payment limit funds. The other $19 million of increase that occurred between the close of session and the fifth special session, the other $20 million of that is the addition of second year funding for the Staley settlement agreement. So those are the big changes that you see under major changes, the $85.3 million Medicaid upper payment limits and the second year funding for the Staley settlement agreement.
George, how much was the total agreement under Staley?
Madam Chair, I know that we have built, or originally what was in the budget for 2003-05 was about 80, in the 85 plus million range. I believe we had about 67 million in 01-03. Under major programs, again, this, like many of the other Department of Human Services programs, we are still going to be serving seniors and people with disabilities and people with developmental disabilities. We're just doing a lot less of the services under the governor's budget than we have done in the past. If I turn to page five, you will see the breakout of where the money goes within this cluster, and you'll see that 85% of it goes to long-term care. That is the residential services or the in-home supports for either people with developmental disabilities or seniors and people with physical disabilities. The other programs, there are some direct financial supports, some Older American Act monies that are funneled through to county governments or to local area agencies on aging, and then you can see the components that are program support and central administration. On page six, 88% of this budget is passed through as special payments. Again, that is through a series of contracts, either money directly sent to the counties or to brokerages or sent directly to long-term care providers. On page seven, I'm going to begin walking you through the changes that happened from the legislatively adopted budget, which was the close of session budget, through where the governor's balanced budget is. And again, a number of these things, as far as the details go that we talked through, will change as part of that reshoot budget that we'll have in the next couple of weeks for you. We started with a budget of $846 million general fund, $2.1 million total funds. You'll see that the legislatively approved actions through April 2002, as we mentioned up earlier, we added two major things to that. One was we initiated the Medicaid upper payment limit financing, and then second, we added the second year funding for the Staley settlement agreement. You'll notice under base budget adjustments that there was an increase of $66 million general fund and $48 million total funds. When we went back and researched this, that number jumped out at us dramatically because it was such a large number. You will see the vast majority of this general fund increase reversed in package 060, which is technical adjustments. When we were initially building the budget for this cluster, We had some monies that were should have been in the mental health budget that were inadvertently sent over to developmental disabilities. So again, most of this general fund increase will disappear in an 060 package that you'll see down below. The essential packages, I'm going to hit the highlight ones for you, which are the most significant. If you turn to page 8, there is the elimination of $144 million of general fund and $278 million of total funds or phased out programs or one-time expenditures that are eliminated. You can see that almost all of that, $140 million general fund and $272 million of total funds, is reversing the Medicaid upper payment limit transactions. That opportunity is phasing out, and we are in a five-year phase-out period, and this package eliminates a lot of the financing, original financing of that.
When we do our 101 walkthrough, it would be well to touch upon that particular issue, because I have some members who don't understand where that MUPL goes.
Madam Chair, we will work through that and make sure that explanation happens.
So that really changes if you're talking about a per cost and some of those issues,
right?
Basis, the MUPL kind of clouds those figures.
That's exactly correct. Now, just for context, we had somewhere between 200 and 300 million of Medicaid upper payment limit financing coming into the state for the 2001-03 biennium. For 03-05, it drops to 75 million. For 05-07, it drops to about 3 million. So it's a very, very steep drop in the loss of these resources. Package 030 is the inflationary increases that we have built in. You'll see that that added 39.2 million of general fund and 93.2 million of total funds. This includes what you may have heard of as nursing facility rebasing, which is an alternate to an inflationary methodology where they actually go back and see actual costs for nursing facilities and, in essence, rebase up their expenditures or their reimbursement rates. You also notice that this inflationary increases are eliminated in the governor's budget in Package 092 later down below. Package 040 are the mandated caseload increases, and you'll see that that adds almost 110 million of general fund and 223 million of total funds. And I've listed there for you the programs that are considered mandated caseload for budget building purposes. Primarily, they are long-term care, those who are eligible for Medicaid and are receiving an entitlement to that program, and also a series of developmental disability client groups who are at risk of civil or criminal commitments, or that we have brought in under the Staley settlement agreement. Madam Chair, I will mention that we are in a unique position right now with senior services in particular. I think everyone is familiar, at least intuitively, with what's happening on the demographic side and the fact that we're going to have a massive increase probably in the next 10 to 15 years as the baby boomers age into that population group. We're actually, for the senior population, probably going to be in a well for the next 5 to 7 years, as right now the people are hitting our 75-plus population. We're the World War II era, and in the demographic literature, there's actually a flattening of that growth curve during that period as there was not as many births. And then in about 10 to 15 years, again, that caseload will go absolutely through the roof. Package 050, the fund shifts, netted an addition of 35.2 million general fund. There were two transactions that happened there. The first one is that, again, Medicaid upper payment limit funding. We reduced the initial transactions that meant that some of the programs we had borrowed money from in 0103 and had used other funds to pay for them in the 0103 biennium, we had to reverse that and add general fund. That equated to about $43 million of that net 35.2. Enhanced Medicaid match rate actually saved us about $7 or $8 million for the net of 35.2 million increase. Turning to page 10, Madam Chair, you'll see at the top of that is the technical adjustments package 060, and you'll see the elimination of $53, $54 million of general fund Again, this is where things were miscoded when we built the budget for 0103, and it simply is sending this money where it was supposed to be going in the first place, which was to mental health services. We shift then to page 11. There are two things there that I want to highlight for you, and neither of these are very significant. First, package 081, which was the third special session. Again, we added Medicaid upper payment limit, limitation of about $29 or $28 million of other fund and federal fund limitation. And then second, in package 083, you will see the very minimal impact of the newest phase of Oregon health plan waivers to coordinate care among the long-term care community. Turning to page 12, there are two packages there to highlight for you in the first large reduction package.
Let me ask you a question. Go back to package 083. Now, what does restoring 1 month to Oregon Project Independence mean?
Madam Chair, when we, through a series of gyrations that that happened through the special sessions and emergency boards, Oregon Project Independence was reduced significantly during the 0103 biennium.
Right.
Part of the confusion that happened is that the program was actually financed with Medicaid upper payment limit. That's one of the places we had borrowed money from in order to get general fund. The emergency board came back in and, as bridge funding for a short period of time, added 1 month, I believe it was the October emergency board or somewhere in there, added 1 month of Oregon Project Independence financing to get us to the November emergency board, where we then had a rebalance plan coming in and we could decide if we could fund the program or not. At the November emergency board, we found that we had additional program savings we had not originally anticipated. And Mr. Britton or Mr. Taves, if I'm incorrect here, please correct me. We decided that we had enough program savings that we could continue the program through the rest of the 2001-03 biennium with some minimal or with some reductions in there. And so the 1 month of funding was the addition of that 1 month of bridge funding between October and November time period.
So now does that mean that OPI is presently not defunded?
Madam Chair, this is where we're partly working through these numbers. My understanding when we had built the governor's budget was that we were eliminating Oregon Project Independence. We now, because of this Medicaid upper payment limit issue, we may have somewhere between $1 and $6 million in the reshoot, but we're still working through that with the department and your legislative fiscal office to exactly figure out how much money we have in Oregon Project Independence.
Further questions on that issue? Thanks.
Okay. Going back to page 12, Madam Chair, you'll see package 084 was the November 2002 emergency board. Caseload reductions from what we had originally anticipated eliminated about $45 million of general fund and $71.5 million of total funds. And then in package 091, you will see the very large roll-up of what we had considered the ballot measure 28 reductions, eliminating $165 million of general fund and $304 million of total funds. Now, what I've done is laid out for you the detail of what was included in the governor's balanced budget. Those individual items have changed, and let me give you a great example of this. The second bullet down under package 091 is eliminating services for clients in survival priority levels 5 through 17. What this body actually considered when you were looking at restoring ballot measure 28 reductions was restoring levels 10 through 17. And what was actually restored was levels 10 and 11. What happened in the interim is that the department worked with our partners in the federal government, and they indicated to us that they would not give us the approval to drop all the way down to level 5. So what the department had to do is substitute different cuts from what had originally been anticipated in the governor's balanced budget. So in order to make up the difference, there were proposed deeper cuts in provider reimbursement levels. And you saw additional reductions in nursing facility reimbursement rates, assisted living facility reimbursement rates, and much of that was restored as part of the statewide balancing bill that was passed out of this body. The point that I'm making here is that the items that are listed here is what's currently in the governor's balanced budget. When the reshoot budget comes in front of you in a couple of weeks, this whole section, or what is included in this package, is going to be different.
Let me just ask you this, George. How vulnerable are we in terms of taking away the provider piece that we had said that we would not take away? That the legislature had made a commitment to.
Madam Chair, I think that your body will have to decide that more than I will. I think that from an access point of view, we know that the levels of reimbursement that we're bringing forward to you, probably as part of the reshoot, is going to have dramatic impacts on what happens with access into these systems. So technically, I think we can do it. It causes dramatic problems as far as getting people into services and the quality of their services. As far as the commitments go and what actually gets funded, I know the co-chairs are looking at a revised budget, as is the governor, for how they balance this out for the next biennium.
Let me ask Mr. Morgan. Thank you. Mm-hmm. What do you think the potential, John, vulnerability is for not funding, not for at least not keeping the legislative commitment to the provider sources?
Well, I would echo Madam Chair and Senator Carter. I would echo what George has said.
I don't think you'd echo that.
You want a different opinion? George and I always agree. We don't always agree. But obviously, it is the same kind of issue that you have with respect to the health plan, and that is access.
Right.
And if you cut provider rates too much, you're going to lose them, some of them, perhaps. And I think it's always a balancing act between paying them adequate rates that keep them in business and provide good care, but not overpaying. That's right. Always the balancing act here.
Yeah. So he gave you the balancing?
Yes, he did.
The argument, yeah.
And Madam Chair, the reason I asked that, because we did an excellent job, I think, of developing cottage industries in this state as we saw with building these small businesses to care for our most vulnerable, and realizing the import of what's going on in our state today. I understand it, but at the same time, how do we try to do something that keeps a commitment to the people that really many of them gave up their jobs, their traditional jobs, in order to do this as a compassionate, caring, economic interest. And so that's the reason my questioning was about this issue and the potential litigiousness of it.
This clearly in this budget environment, whether we're talking about the seniors and people with disability services or whether we're talking about the Oregon Health Plan, is a very, very serious issue. Access to care in the state, and how we're going to be able to fairly pay the providers that are providing the service. It is probably, I think, one of the most critical issues that we will have to address within this environment. And I can appreciate all the work that was done, particularly when we went through the whole phases of the close down of Fairview and the integration of the citizens into our basic society, and the commitments that were made when we made those transitions, and then to now be faced with some severe budget decisions that says, can we continue at the level of those commitments that we had made? And that fundamentally is the question that we're going to have to ask as a legislative body, and as we set priorities. Clearly we've been talking. I'd asked earlier the question of how much did the courts state that we needed to put into the Staley settlement. There's some of those pieces that are there that drives these budgets, and they're going to be very difficult decisions for this body to make.
Madam Chair, if I could just add that, as George indicated, in the original governor's balanced budget, the provider cuts were not as deep as they were subsequently proposed, because we were trying to balance how deep we would go into the level cuts and cutting clients out of services versus the provider cuts. And, of course, the deeper you go on either side, you have hydraulics. And when we decided, based on all of our discussions with the federal government, that we couldn't go nearly as deep in the level cuts as we had originally proposed, then the cuts drove much, much deeper on the provider side. And the concern we have, of course, is, and a lot of people ask us how many programs would close and things like that. We can't give precise answers, but we know you'd have a lot of dislocation, you'd have some closures, you'd have a lot of instability, and you'd push out into the private market as well, because much of what we do on the senior and disability side is public financing, but then private pay. And so if you have an agency or a program that has a big percentage of its budget that's Medicaid that's going down and has a small amount of private pay left, whether they can keep the facility open for primarily the private pay people is a big question. So it has a lot of sort of ripple impacts across the entire service spectrum.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, if I continue with another thought about that, the reimbursement levels that ultimately this body approves are going to have direct impacts on these caseloads down the road. And so, for example, a couple biennia ago we had, or maybe even last biennia, it's all faded at this point, we had some proposed reductions to assisted living facility rates, and that caused, actually we did a study with a provider that actually, or someone that did contracting market research to figure out what was viable as far as rates go. One of the things that they pointed out was that the way that the rates were set at that time for assisted living facilities actually encouraged the development of more of those facilities. It was high enough that people were getting into the business. As you build more capacity, you start sending more people to that new capacity that's out there. As this body looks at those reimbursement levels, you have to remember that you can't look at any one provider individually. You have to look at the entire system, because if you incentivize one piece of the system over another, you're going to drive additional costs into that particular component. So that's another thing for this body to weigh through as it's going through. As far as package 091 goes, there's one other thing.
Not, and you better add the other caveat to that particular piece, because the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that public policy, the state encouraged the development of some of those ALFs, and also we're holding mortgages on some of those ALFs. So last session we had a lot of discussion surrounding whether or not we would have to, whether there would be default. So these are all issues that this body must look at.
That's correct. Madam Chair, the one last thing on package 091 that I will again mention, because it's very, very significant. The first bullet there is that the governor's balanced budget did not include funding for the Staley Settlement Agreement. It was outside of the governor's budget, and that will be part of the discussion for both the co-chairs and the governor's in his revised budget. You'll see that we eliminated almost $86 million of general fund related to Staley in the governor's budget. Since that time, there's been some revisions to that, and the newest package that I have seen would be about $56 million. So that is currently where that sits. Package 092, Madam Chair, is the elimination of the inflationary increases. You'll see that eliminated about $30 million general fund and $71 million of total funds. You notice that number is different than what was in package 030 above, which is the inflationary increase. The reason it's different, quite simply, is that we did not want to double count the elimination of nursing facility rebasing and some of the other heightened increases that had been included in package 091. So there's a little play there. Madam Chair, I'm going to finish. There are two other small packages that you need to be aware of, or a series of packages. The first one is package 172, adds total funds or federal funds and other funds for some small grants related to employing people with disabilities. There was an Oregon employment initiative out of the last regular session, and this simply adds the positions and some total funds for a series of grants that were being brought in related to that program. On page 14, Madam Chair, the last piece, and I've bundled all three of these together, there are a series of changes to the estate recoveries procedure. Under Medicaid law, if a client has received services under Medicaid, you are able to, in essence, recover from the estate of the decedent some of the costs related to Medicaid. This makes some changes that would allow us to increase our reimbursement or our recapture of some of those resources, changing things like requiring banks to give notice to the department when the decedent is pulling some or the estate is being pulled out of. Madam Chair, that is really the end of my presentation. What I think I would like to do at this point is turn it over to Mr. Taves and have him explain to you a little bit about the difficulties we've had in actually the list that you saw for the ballot measure 28 versus what ultimately we're going to end up doing.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Jim.
Thanks, Madam Chair. James Taves from Senior and Disability Services in the Department of Human Services. Picking up from yesterday, what I'd like to do is take a little bit of time and help frame the issues that we've struggled with as we've begun the process of making significant reductions in this budget, because we've gone through a whole series of different changes that have seemed very confusing to many of our clients and to many of our providers as well, and I want to sort of give the context for that. Mr. Britton said yesterday that our system has sort of been good news, bad news. Good news in that it's been a very expansive Medicaid program in what we've been able to offer people in community services, even though we don't spend a lot more than other states spend overall, but the offering on the community side has been one of the most expansive home and community-based waivers really anywhere in the country. And in many ways, the senior and disability system has been the safety net also for other populations in the department. In mental health, for example, people that have had long histories of mental health who may not now have a primary diagnosis or have a serious episode of mental illness, but nonetheless need long-term care and support in their daily activities. In many cases, we've been able to pick up financial support or housing support for people with mental health needs. The same is true for people with developmental disabilities, where in other parts of the department they were locked out based on categorical definitions, and historically in the senior system we used functional definitions. We looked at what a person needs to support them on a daily basis to stay in the community as opposed to a diagnostic category. And so the old SDSD kind of was able to provide, at least in some cases, that safety net in long-term care. And in many ways, our system was designed to get people in, not to keep people out or to get people out. And within recent months now, we're making sort of this massive shift on how we start major gatekeeping activities. We get very technical on eligibility and focus on how much we have left in resources and how many people we can serve and serve reasonably well with those resources. That is a huge shift in this system, and I'm sure you're going to be hearing a lot about that in the next couple of days.
Senator Gordon, thank you very much, and good afternoon. Welcome back.
Thanks.
It would be very helpful if, as you are walking through the budget reduction choices and issues, if you would also identify for us, aside from this daily settlement, where are the other possible lawsuits that we should be aware of? If there are pending lawsuits, please tell us about those to the extent that you are able to give us information so that we have that information in front of us as well. Are you able to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, we can do that. We have quite a number of lawsuits that have been filed against the department, and we could certainly share with you a list of those lawsuits and what the issues are that they've that they're addressing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I make the request because I'm not aware that we've yet assembled a list across all of the budget committees that tell us where the lawsuits may be hanging out there.
Because it's probably broader than Mr. Tate's responsibility, why don't I ask the department to put together a list of all of those that actually have gone to court and have had a requirement, and then those that are pending or that are in the process, so that it takes in all of them rather than just the ones that deal with the senior and disabled services and the people with disabilities, because it's broader than
it is. And Madam Chair, I would just say that we made that earlier request of the department, but we haven't received any information, so that's why I'm bringing it up again.
Mr. Naughton, would you check with
yes, ma'am.
The agency? Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could turn to page 33 in the handout has titled Budget Reduction Choices and Issues. The first major issue in reshaping this budget has to do with the Medicaid program, which, as we discussed yesterday, funds the vast majority of services that are provided in long-term care. And as we began the reduction process, we had many, many discussions with the federal government on how to do sort of sweeping changes to the Medicaid program, because anything that we have done and still yet need to do, we have to seek federal approval, similar to the health plan. Much of what we fund is through waivers on the long-term Medicaid side, and each time that we cut benefits or change eligibility, we have to go back, submit those changes in a revised or amended application to the federal government, and then negotiate those approvals. Several things have come out of this that really box us in to some extent, that limit our choices in where we can focus the reductions and how we set priorities for our clients. First of all, the state, to have any Medicaid program at all, has to provide basic nursing and rehabilitation services. So even if you eliminated all of your home and community-based services, all of your waivers, at the end of the day, there still is a clear federal requirement that we would have to admit people to nursing facilities and provide basic rehab services in order to have any other Medicaid dollar at all. So that's one of the sort of the cornerstones that we have to work with. The second thing is that, particularly as we look at reduction scenarios, the federal government has made it very clear we have to help protect the health and safety of people that are leaving services. And that is a very large challenge at a time when we're exiting literally thousands of people out of service about how, in fact, you provide assurances that you will meet their health and safety needs, particularly for those individuals that may not have active family or community networks that are still around to pick up support if they're losing service from us. The third big Medicaid issue for us is what's called statewideness or comparability. When we started the reduction exercises, we looked throughout our budget at ways that we could grandfather the most vulnerable. So, for example, we said the last thing we want to do is move people out of 24-hour care. If they're in foster care or an ELF or a residential setting or a nursing facility, to move a person out of 24-hour care is almost unthinkable. And so the first choices where we originally looked was that we would start cutting services to people still living in their own homes. The federal requirements, as we've gone through them at length, are very clear that you can't grandfather and you can't make substitutions of that site. Whatever you end up with as a Medicaid program, whoever is eligible, and person A who looks like person B in your Medicaid program, both you have to serve. So you can't say we're going to grandfather in a certain group, then close the front door and not serve people subsequently coming into the Medicaid program that have identical profiles. So the ability to grandfather some of the most vulnerable people violates Medicaid and would have put our Medicaid waiver in jeopardy. And again, that seems almost nonsensical from sort of a logical point of view of how you protect people as you're making reductions. But that's been one of the dilemmas that we're working with. The last is a very technical issue, a very legal issue, and I don't even pretend to be anywhere near an expert on it. But under federal law and based on federal litigation, if a state uses an income standard in long-term care above 100% of SSI, which is roughly $552 a month. If you use an income standard above that, and Oregon does, we use a standard at 300% of SSI, which is a little over $1,600 a month in income, and then a limit of $2,000 in assets to be eligible for the Medicaid long-term care program. If you use a standard above 100%, people can use what's called an income cap trust or a Miller trust to shelter their income and, in essence, buy their way down into the Medicaid program. And so even historically, people that are over 300% of the SSI income level in Oregon have been able to shelter income and become Medicaid eligible. This becomes a very important issue in terms of the threshold that you use in income in deciding how big or how small your Medicaid program in long-term care is going to be. And Elizabeth Lopez, who is presenting, I think, the day after tomorrow, will have some more information on that, but it's quite a complex issue. With those constraints, we then set about the task of trying to figure out which reduction scenarios in this budget we could make. And we went back and forth many times between using assessment levels around service priority or survival priorities. And we're going to, I'm sure, going to get into quite a bit of detail as we go on in this. In long-term care in Oregon, in addition to being income eligible for the Medicaid, which currently is 300% of SSI, no more than $2,000 in assets, you also have to be eligible through a survival priority level set in administrative rule that's keyed to an instrument or a tool, an electronic assessment tool that we use that we have developed in recent years with the federal government with their full approval, and which has been rolled out statewide where case managers at the local level do assessments using this electronic tool. And we have service priority levels 1 through 17, which are ranked 1 with the most profound impairments up to level 17, which are the least profound impairments. And historically, that's how we've done the service ranking. But the important fact to remember is to get into the Medicaid program in Oregon, you only have to be at 17 or below. That got you in the door into long-term care, assuming you were also income eligible. So historically, the level system was used for establishing initial eligibility, and it was used to help plan what type of services that individual would use. That eligibility system was never used to go sort of up and down through the levels in deciding who is eligible and who is not eligible. So that is a huge shift in our service system. And originally, as George indicated, in the governor's balanced budget, to meet the targets, particularly after with the reductions of post Measure 28, combined with the revenue shortfall in December, we had to go even below level 5, well into level 3, before you could achieve the budget target, cutting down through the survival priorities. That meant that Oregon, again, assuming you met the income standard, would have served only people that were totally dependent with very, very severe impairments and total care, and anybody else would have been excluded completely from our long-term care system. In our discussions with the federal government, it was very, very clear that they would not approve waivers to go that deep, that we would be in violation of the basic Medicaid standard of nursing facility care and rehabilitation that's required, again, before a state can have any Medicaid at all. So we knew we had to come back up on the survival priority levels if we were going to win federal approval. Then to meet the budget target, we looked at other ways, focusing primarily on income, whether or not we should set the priorities largely through income. And initially, we priced different reduction scenarios based on percentages of SSI and said, well, we're at 300% of SSI. What happens if we go to 250% or we go to 200%? Is that a way, perhaps, of setting a more fair, objective standard? Because income is income, and it's very easy to measure, and it's pretty objective. But that gets us back to what I talked about a minute ago is under federal law, and again, based on a history of litigation, if you have any income standard above 100% of SSI, a person could go out, get an income cap trust, and buy their way back in. So it really didn't become a vehicle going to different levels of income. However, if you go flatly to 100% of SSI, if you say that is the income cutoff, and nobody above that income of $552 a month, roughly, can get into long-term care. You can exclude the income cap trust. You can hold the line at that. And we actually, in looking at one of our scenarios, priced the cuts all the way down to 100% of SSI. And we've gone through that exercise again now in terms of what potential further reductions the governor or the legislature may have to take. Going to 100% of SSI is very draconian. It excludes nearly two-thirds of the people that we serve in long-term care. It would turn out of service about 10,000 individuals, of which nearly 8,000 are in 24-hour care. Plus, it goes across all populations. It goes across developmental disabilities. It affects some people in mental health because you have to cap it across the board for the entire population. So we looked at that. Plus, that, at least at the time we were looking at that budget reduction scenario, went much deeper than even what our target was. So we threw out the 100%. We said that's not going to work. We went back to the level cuts, and then based on further negotiations with the federal government, we settled at levels 1 through 9 and said below 10, we think we're really at risk of federal disapproval of our entire home and community-based waiver. And that's kind of where we have drawn the line. And that's what we proposed, and then, of course, the legislature restored at least till the end of this biennium, Measures 10 and 11. So we are now focusing on cutting services in people levels 12 through 17. Again, to emphasize, and it really is becoming a major issue for us, these survival levels were not designed originally as a means of triaging people or cutting people out of service. That wasn't the original intent. They were designed to do broad eligibility and service planning. And now we're using them very discreetly. If you're at level 11, you're still in. If you're at 11-12, you're out. And that's
in drawing the line and looking at, I'm a caseworker, and I know the line is drawn at 9 or 10. How much is being done in our field staff to try to make work to where the person fits within those categories?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, and we're dealing with that a lot every day at the present time. What we did, once we decided that we would use the survival priorities, not the 100% of SSI, as the strategy for making the reduction, we did a couple things. We tightened up the administrative rule. In December and I think in January, we went across the state and did a huge number of trainings for field staff, both in our state offices and in our county offices in the AAAs. We did, I don't know how many netcasts directly for case managers to provide a lot more information about how the assessment process is used for much more discrete measurement for people that are in or out. We have done weekly phone calls, conferences, and focusing on the numbers, where they're going, what the trends are. So within a relatively short amount of time, we've tried to mount a major effort to, in effect, convert this assessment process into a much more discrete measurement tool. Do we have concerns? Yes, we have concerns. I think both we and the field at this point share significant concerns about this. Within the last month, between ourselves and all our field staff, we have launched a major review. We are very aggressively going out and checking all the assessments that have been done. We're doing random samples. We're pulling up cases where we think there may be concern, and we'll do a pretty exhaustive review of that. And at the state office, we are also going out, and we're pulling samples and looking at cases. And I think that we agree that even more has to be done. We're going to have to do a lot more training We're going to have to do a lot more testing over time again because we're converting a system from a different use to a much more discrete system now, really for triaging people in and out. And I think that's going to be a major task for us in the months to come.
Senator Morris.
Just so I'm clear, the income trust caps are not in play at this point. It's just strictly based on the survival levels. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, no, not exactly. The income cap trust is still at play because we're above 100% of SSI. So people can still use the income cap trust to become eligible on the income side.
Thank you. Could you set the parameters for these trusts by way of income? If someone has, say, a $50,000 a year income, can they set up trusts that put them into eligibility?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, what I prefer to do is we'll bring you, if that's okay, some specific examples of how that trust works and how you can shelter income, how you can do spousal orders that shifts part of the resources to the spouse so the other spouse is then Medicaid eligible. And I think if we give you a set of examples, but in some cases, yeah, individuals with considerable income can shelter income and ultimately become Medicaid eligible. We've changed our administrative rules within the last series of months. We've tightened up the criteria for that. We used to pay, historically, we'd pay the attorney fees for those trusts being set up, and we'd even amortize some of the long-term costs of operating that trust. We've scaled that way back. But, yeah, that is still a vehicle, and I think we could walk you through how exactly those trusts work.
Follow up.
Did that fulfill the statutory intent, the procedures that you were just referring to, in terms of paying attorney's fees and actually encouraging people to, in high income brackets, to buy their way into the program? That was a part of statutory intent?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I don't think that was as much statutory intent. It certainly wasn't prohibited by statute, and it simply was what Oregon historically had done. So it wasn't either required or not, or prohibited, I should say.
I would appreciate having more information in that on that subject.
James, I would also appreciate how much we have paid in attorney fees for that population. And if you get that information to us, I think I share the same concern that's being expressed by my good senator here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't know if we have information that goes back that far, but again, we have changed all the administrative rules to tighten up those criteria significantly.
James, is that rule tighten up that now the court says that we do not pay legal fees?
Correct. I believe so. I'll have Ms. Lopez give you all the details on that. Madam Chair, moving to page 35. In developmental disabilities, we had slightly different choices because in this program, the eligibility is a diagnostic or a categorical eligibility. It's not based on survival priorities. The eligibility is a person with mental retardation or developmental disability, generally two standard deviations below the norm in terms of IQ, to use the technical term, which typically means a person with an IQ of less than 70 or a severe other type of developmental disability, cerebral palsy, autism, or things that has a similar effect to retardation that requires major support and supervision in both daily activities and in care. So that's how we have screened people in or out. It's been through diagnostic. And on the developmental disability side, the choices we made in 5100 was essentially to eliminate non-24-hour care, again, with the argument that the first line of defense you draw is for people that are in the full-time care of of the state or of community programs. And again, that would have pushed out very, very hard on families, on in-home support, and effectively eliminated the Staley Agreement, which was another box that we're in, but that was the choice we made. And again, that has been temporarily restored through the duration of the biennium as we decide where the budget's going and whether or not we can settle with the plaintiffs on some reduced level to keep that agreement alive. And then the other major issues as well that we considered was how deep the rate cuts, and we talked about this just briefly, could really go. And we drove them very, very deep again when we decided we could not go as deep as we could on the level cuts. And Julia Huddleston, I think tomorrow, will walk you through the rate reductions that are still in the proposed budget. It's about 30% in the assisted living facilities, and about 15% in nursing facilities, foster care, residential care programs. So we'll give you a detailed description of that. The other issue that we faced as we made all of these reductions was that many individuals also lose health care. When they lose long-term care, in many cases, the eligibility for health care came via the eligibility for long-term care, because once a person is eligible for Medicaid, they're eligible for Medicaid, and they get it both on the long-term care side and on the acute care side as well. So as we eliminated long-term care services, depending then where they are in income or the other eligibility standards that apply in the health plan, be it the plus or standard or whatever, and we'll give you a breakdown of what's happened in long-term care as those people lose service and where they end up in health care, whether they have any benefits left at all. Madam Chair, moving to page 36, because very briefly, I just want to mention some of the big challenges ahead, and I know we'll probably come back to that in the next several days, but I wanted to frame that again before we start going into the detailed program-by-program descriptions. As Mr. Naughton mentioned, even without the current budget crisis, the long-term care system is heading towards a major fiscal crisis anyway, with the population demographics. We're going to double the number of people that are over age 65 in the next 20 to 30 years. Oregon, in fact, is one of the oldest states, and I think by the 2010, if I'm not mistaken, will be, I think, the second oldest state in the country. And the cohort or the portion of the aging population that's growing the most rapidly are those over age 85. So many people, as we well know, 65 to 85, if they're in good health, probably don't need much from our long-term care support. But that subgroup of those over age 85 are growing, and they will more than double within the next 20 to 30 years.
One of my senior members would like to weigh in, so it feels.
Senior to who, Madam Chair? We're not going to get into an age debate here, are we?
Not with a lady.
Not with a lady.
No.
I'm not going to go anywhere with that either. A serious question. Quite often people get real flip when I ask the question, why is Oregon aging more rapidly than other states? And they just come back saying, well, it's such a great place to retire or whatever. Has anything serious ever been asked as to why? I mean, but the corollary of the question is, are there any other states that are doing anything that we can learn? Have you learned anything from any other states about how to deal with this crisis? I mean, we're not the only one that's there. In fact, everything that I hear from you guys is that we're doing better than most states in terms of being ahead of the curve with programs that are less expensive.
Madam Chair and Senator, you're absolutely right that I think we have done better simply because we've offered so many community options and sort of kept the institutional part of our service system at a pretty low level. Other states are beginning to focus on this. There's a lot of a very serious discussion going on, and much of it focuses around how you build up community support systems that aren't part of the formal long-term care system combined with healthy aging. I think we will see, and I hope we'll see it sooner than later in Oregon, a huge campaign on healthy aging, how exercise and diet, almost like anti-smoking, something that really becomes a major public information campaign, because some of the smallest changes in diet and even exercise for a person that's well up in years can begin to have a dramatic effect on their long-term care. And to the degree that we can help ourselves as boomers and the aging population be much healthier, then the long-term care, the formal long-term care system won't have to pick up that much of the burden. There are states that are piloting natural caregiving communities and how you hook up neighbors and support systems that allow people to check up on each other and help support each other, again, instead of the formal paid support of sending in caregivers or admitting people into long-term care. Housing. If we could make a huge impact in making much of what we do in housing, including new construction, accessible. I moved my aging mother and father because it didn't work in the house anymore, and the cost of making that house accessible didn't work, and so we end up often not allowing people to age in place simply because of the environmental issues. So I think we will begin to see some very concrete ideas that states will launch in a very major way, because we can't buy our way out of this. And even if we had the money to purchase long-term care for this massive upswing in the population, we don't have the staff. Because, and I think we have a graph that we'll show you in a day or two that essentially says the entry-level workforce is going like this, and the demand is going like this. So even if we have the dollars, we won't have the entry-level staff that could provide the direct care anyway. So this really is, this is the thing that I think makes everybody in long-term care lose lots of sleep, because we're rapidly reaching that point, and we don't have early solutions at this point.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Your comments talking about that in the next 10 to 20 years, we have a true crisis on our hands. Would it be possible to get information that gives more detail about that, both about the trends and what solutions are out there on the horizon, so that way some of us who are still in the 101 mode can learn a little bit more about that? And then a question is there an opportunity to provide an incentive for citizens to obtain private long-term coverage? And if there is, what is it? Or if there isn't, what should there be? Because I would imagine there's a public policy issue there, and if we could figure out how to address that issue, maybe there's a way of freeing up dollars for even more vulnerable folks.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, those are excellent questions. We will get you data from the Governor's Task Force on Senior Services, which has met over the last several of years, and they did quite a bit of study on sort of the aging demographics, and we'll pull some of that information together for you. I didn't respond to Senator Shields' question about why Oregon is one of the oldest states, and I'll see what we did in any of our research for the Governor's Task Force on that. So we'll provide that information, and any information we have. We have talked about exploring long-term care insurance. Hawaii has piloted some ideas about establishing long-term care insurance. We've talked, and the Governor's Task Force talked about that, and we've talked internally and with people from our field of actually putting a task group together to really explore what long-term care insurance might look like and how much of the gap it could pick up. So anything we can pull together on that we have that we will share.
Just to follow up.
I
guess just as an observation, I think there's a real opportunity there. And if it's something we could do as part of the legislative assembly, I think we ought to be looking at that. It's okay to bring the private sector in to assist in this, especially if that frees up dollars for more vulnerable folks. Thank you, Chair.
When I was back, it was last month or recently, and had lunch with the president, that was one issue that I discussed with
the president, in looking at his Medicaid package, that although, you know, we welcome the new dollars, the additional dollars, but recognizing that I believe his package goes for 7 years, that we're going to go down a cliff. And that there is the need to look to incentivizing and to talk about getting the baby boomers and those earlier than the baby boomers in age to begin carrying long-term care insurance, and how could we incentivize this to so that that begins to happen. I think you're correct.
I have the coverage.
That we do need to look at how we can make this happen, not only from the state of Oregon, but this is a huge national issue. You know, we talk about that we're in the aging population here in Oregon, but we all are living longer, you know, through medical technology and some of the things that have happened. And it is serious. It will be a serious crisis 10 years from now if we don't do something. So I thank you for raising that, because it is of interest. And I'm hoping that the president heard my message.
I'm sure he did. Just to wrap up, a couple other items. We've already talked about the rate cuts, and we'll get more into that. But both for our local government partners, and this is true what we do on the developmental disability side as well as on the aging side, we're concerned about the stability going forward there, and that issue will keep coming up as well. The last thing I want to focus on is how we're going to manage very limited caseload growth for next biennium. And of course, we don't know exactly what the budget is going to be at this point. We know it's not going to be good, and we know that we will probably have very limited caseload growth opportunities for next biennium. We are very concerned, and we are starting major discussions in our office with all of our partners in the field about what we do if we're limiting caseload growth on the community services side, no matter where we end up in terms of eligibility. If we only have levels 1 through 9 or something above that, but if we end up only with levels 1 through 9, that group is still eligible, and we will still have new individuals presenting themselves that clearly qualify, meet the income requirements, and meet the impairment requirements to be eligible for long-term care. But we may not be able to finance that caseload. At the same time, for those who are still eligible for your long-term care Medicaid program, you have to admit them to nursing facilities if they require that or they demand that. You can't cap that part of the program. So I think we're going to enter a very, very prolonged, careful balancing act between who we admit to community services and the risks we pose if they end up going into nursing facilities. Because if we simply cap or clamp down completely and shut off the spigot, so to speak, on the community side, and that nursing facility caseload starts to escalate very quickly, we're then serving people at almost 2 to 3 times the cost that we otherwise could have provided on the community side. So we don't have answers at this point, and we're just beginning the discussions on how we would manage that kind of caseload, how we set criteria beyond just being eligible, how we would set the criteria for who gets in and who doesn't to manage potential costs shooting out on the facility side.
Senator Shields.
Jim, I appreciate you addressing it that way, and I believe you. I really do. But yet sometimes when we look at this, we see the effort at limiting the caseload growth, and we don't feel like, I'm just going to say it the way I feel it, we don't feel like sometimes you really look at the result that, in your own words, could result in exploding nursing home admissions. Why is that? I mean, I talk to a lot of providers out there and a lot of people in need, and they see the one end, and they keep saying, this is not going to save the state money because it's going to result in this exploding caseload growth. So how are you responding to all of us in the legislature if we're trying to cut the budget, which is really not going to save us money? It's like we see only the part of the elephant we want to see or something. I don't understand this.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, in part it becomes short-term, long-term strategies. In the short term, if you don't have the money, you don't have the money. And if your caseload growth is capped or limited, then you have to look at what do you really do with that, and do you set up such stringent criteria that, unlike how we've historically operated, that we then only wait, we put people on waiting lists. They get more impaired as they sit on waiting lists, or their family situations deteriorate to the point where they can't provide care at home. And only at sort of the very last minute do we insert some level of community service, because they're almost at immediate risk within a day or two of going into a nursing facility. I mean, that's how you can at least attempt to control those costs in the short term. Where that will start to poke out over time is your per case cost will start to go up, because people are waiting for services, they're becoming more impaired. If they don't have health care or drug coverage, they're getting sicker. And so at the point in time that we finally triage them into service, the per cost, even if they remain on the community side, then will be much higher than. But, I mean, those are the kinds of hydraulics that we simply have to deal with now. I don't think we have much of a choice. What our goal is, our overriding goal, if I can say that, is to preserve the elements and the framework of the service system that Oregon has created. Because I think Oregon, based on, again, from the other day, the legislative policy going all the way back to 1991, I think we have framed a very, very good policy in this state. And now we're trying to figure out how you maintain that policy when you're ratcheting it way back in terms of dollars and the numbers of people you're serving. But I think at a minimum, we have to keep the framework. You have to balance your potential institutional costs with some level of growth on the community side to keep the institutional side from going through the roof, because obviously that wouldn't save any money. And where that balance is going to be, I don't think we know today, and I think that's the type of balances we'll be trying to figure out within the next day, a couple of days, and a couple of months.
Senator Morris, if Senator Fields has completed.
No, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question that Senator Shields raises begs another question, and it's a public policy question. Where does the responsibility lie for care for our vulnerable citizens? And the role of the family, immediate family, extended family, faith-based institutions, as we've transitioned to government picking up that responsibility, it's shifted, and now we're faced with probably a public policy question as to where should that responsibility lie and how should it be balanced. You know, it just kind of amazes me, actually, that we would have a policy of encouraging income cap trusts and paying attorney's fees for people with means to gain access to programs that were intended for the most vulnerable. So, you know, and to the extent that that has permeated throughout our social service delivery, the question really may be more appropriately directed to the responsibility issue and those outside of government. Wherein does that responsibility really lie? That's a big question, not for deliberation here, Madam Chair, but
That's a big policy question that only the legislature can address. And it even goes beyond that, because when you look at the linkages between federal policy and state policy, and what drives these budgets and the human needs, they're fastened together. I think sometimes we look at these with thinking that we've got some simplistic answers, and then when we go back and try to come to a place to where we deal with the issues in Oregon, we find that we're under a federal mandate someplace, or we find that there's a court activity that has directed some activity, and so it's taking all those pieces. I agree with you on the issue of the cap, and of course, with anything we do, I think, in government, in law, somebody tries to find a way around something that was put in there for well intentions, and it ended up getting
overly used or abused. I did ask the question whether or not that was still in practice, and I believe James said that no, it is not in practice. Am I correct, James?
Madam Chair,
that's the cap of the providing attorneys for to assist individuals in
correct, Madam Chair.
That is
and the income cap trust again is a federal issue. I mean, that's not an issue that the state has control of. What Oregon did is we had a fairly permissive and liberal policy to allow income cap trusts by covering a portion of the attorney fees or part of the ongoing care cost of the trust. But the income cap trust issue itself is a matter of federal law and a lot of litigation that's happened around that. So we, the state, can't arbitrarily cut that off. We can tighten the parameters of that, but we can't exclude it.
But they can, which says that they have done, is to cut off the things like legal fees and things like that. I want to go back to something that you said, James, and that is that to preserve the structure and the framework. As we work here on budgets, I think it's very important that we keep that in mind, that we do want to be able to preserve structure and framework. I was reminded by my former boss, Governor Attia, that the economy is not going to stay the same always, and we need to be able to have to be able to build back on. If we become draconian and get rid of the structure, we won't have that ability to do that. And I just have to say that there are systems that we put in place in Oregon that have served us well, and I think as we go through this, we want to make sure that we do retain structure and we do maintain frameworks at work. So that when the economy is healthier again, that we're able to do some rebuilding. So,
Madam Chair, let me make one small correction. George wisely counseled me to say the right thing here. We don't actually go out and pay attorneys to set up income cap trusts. We've allowed those attorney fees to be part of the offset of the person's income. So it's not, we're not actually handing a check to attorneys setting up these trusts. We simply, as the person sets up the trust, then that counts as an offset against their income, against their long-term care. So we'll lay out sort of the model of how that works for you. So,
any additional questions?
Madam Chair, that concludes my sort of overview, and if you're ready, we can start.
We'll go to day two.
Proceed into the program descriptions, and I want to have Mary Lee Fay, who heads up our Office of Home and Community Supports, come and walk you through day two.
Welcome, Mary Lee.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm the administrator for the Office of Home and Community Supports with Seniors and People with Disabilities in Department of Human Services. And as James mentioned, I'm beginning day two in your handout, which actually will start on page 40. And Madam Chair, as you just referenced talking about infrastructure, what I'd like to do today is walk people through what is the infrastructure for the Medicaid long-term care part of our programs. What is eligibility? What are the services that people can get under this program? How is it delivered? And the impact of some of those reductions that we've taken this fiscal year. I'd like to first do it for explain the services as it relates to seniors and people with disabilities. Then I'll go through a similar report for people with developmental disabilities and wrap up with the program on Oregon Project Independence. So starting on page 40, James yesterday talked about is just the definition of long-term care, but it's just a reminder that what we do is provide services and supports that are needed over time to a person due to a person's age or disabilities, and that our role is to make sure that they're living in a safe and healthy environment, and we're promoting choice, independence, and dignity, and those are pretty critical values that we operate throughout our whole program. We serve, as James mentioned yesterday, seniors and people with physical disabilities in the Medicaid program who have significant impairments in activities of daily living, listed, such as bathing, mobility, eating, cognition, elimination, or toileting. We also, for children and adults with developmental disabilities, we also provide assistance in daily living, special care and supervision, and a frequent supervision for individuals who need a lot of assistance in hearing, language, mobility, and judgment. Kind of setting that framework, moving to page 43 and talking about what is the eligibility for long-term care for seniors and people with physical disabilities. And there are two requirements. The first is financial. And as James mentioned, in Oregon we use 300% of the Social Security income, and which is we also are allowed $2,000 in assets. So it's about $1,650 per person if you're a single person. The other thing we do, though, is not only do you need to be financially eligible, you have to have an eligibility of care needs. You have to meet service priority level rules, and James has already talked about the challenge of those particular rules in terms of identifying how people have used them in terms of eliminating services, but it's also critical for the access to services. Starting on page 44 and going through to page 49, I've actually included how those service priority levels are looked at and what the levels are. And I thought it's important to look at a couple things. First of all, the service priority level rules are prioritized based on critical activities of daily living, and we rank some of those higher than others. So the issue of eating might be ranked higher than that of dressing. But it's also in conjunction with the level of assistance that's needed. And you'll see in here terms like substantial assistance versus minimal assistance. And really what it relates to is how much a person can do on their own and how much care they will need from another person, with a full assistance meaning the entire task is supported by another person. So in these service priority levels, you'll see level one being the person who is most impaired, requiring the most amount of assistance, all the way through to level 17, where there is assistance needing in one of the areas that is not as critical, such as eating. So it's bathing and dressing. The other thing that was mentioned yesterday was some of the subjectivity that might be utilized when trying to apply a tool like this. And although each person is looked at in their own environment and each case manager is applying it to a person, we really have case managers apply some other tools that they need to do while filling these out. So it's not just about asking a question and getting an answer. Case managers actually have to do a lot of observation. So they don't just ask questions about how do you move around your apartment, but they're there to see. They're there to use their observation. They also will meet with people and get information from people who know them well, so that if someone is not a very good communicator about how their needs are, they will talk to other family members, they'll talk to a care provider. They gather information from more than just the person who's being assessed. And lastly, they may look for medical verification. So they're looking for additional information from a doctor, from another clinician, and that gets put together and really helps so that the judgment of how does a person fit into one of these service levels becomes a little more criteria based on the observation and feedback that others are giving. If you look on page 50, I've given three examples of people who meet these particular levels.
Madam Chair, I'm not ready to look at page 50 just yet. Okay. I'm going to give you a hypothetical question, but something that could become real. We all know that we've cut from levels 18, 17, whatever, down to 10, 9, or wherever we're heading. Mm-hmm. What if you have a person, for instance, that would be at level 5, hypothetically, less impaired than the others, but at this level they need substantial assistance with mobility and assistance with eating and elimination. If they're in that level or 6, substantial assistance with mobility and eating. And if they're in a nursing home and if they still have cognition enough to know that they've used up all their money because of the great American way of doing things, where, you know, you can work all your life and you spend yourself into poverty, then you're ready for Medicaid because you didn't think about the long-term care insurance earlier. But you get down here and you still have enough cognition to know that now you're in this nursing home, your house is gone, you don't have it anymore, and you don't have any family left. And with 114,000, you know, constituents, I'm thinking of a couple. That put the person with the mobility need into a little bit of therapy to try to get them walking. And where's the incentive, you know, for them to try to improve themselves if they could actually get to the point where they were more mobile and maybe move themselves from level 6 or 7 or whatever up to 13 or 14 or whatever, if it means they lose their housing? Because the only place left they've got is the nursing home, because the home that they've lived in no longer exists because they sold it because they had to pay for this nursing home they're in. I'm just trying to think this through. How does this make sense?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I understand the issue of the incentives. I think what you will have seen is in past years, many people actually do are eligible for systems, but based on improvements, based on a change in health need or improvements through therapies, actually do end up being at a higher or lower, as these might be, they may have been assessed at an 18 or beyond and have left the system. I think during that time, there are some critical things that need to occur. And part of it is planning within the system and looking, and it's one of the many roles that case managers take on beyond just assessments and eligibility, but is the planning and the work that goes into what does it take to support you today, as well as what are the supports that get you there tomorrow. I think many people are motivated to improve for the sake of being improved. I think the healthcare and the ability to have better walking skills are pretty great motivators for many people.
And, Madam Chair, I think other people are motivated just to lay down and die. And I wonder about the civility of that system. I mean, you could say some people, yeah, they're motivated. I'd be motivated to get up and walk out of the place if I could. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if I've already spent myself into poverty and have nowhere to walk to when I walk out the door, my alternative, if I'm 85, is to lay down and die.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, just again, when we originally looked at this, we thought we should grandfather certain people. Because it's different once you've taken someone into care, it's very different than who you keep out of care in the future. Because if you keep people out of care, then they don't sell their house. And even as these cuts loomed, many of our case managers and were calling in and saying, even though you haven't made the change, technically people are still eligible. Should we really be discouraging everybody to not make any arrangements for that very reason, that if you give up any link you have left to the community? So I think it's a very different question about how people plan their futures if they haven't been in service versus if they have been. And quite frankly, if we'd had both the money and the federal capacity to simply grandfather whole groups, saying, you know, they've sort of cast their lot in life, their circumstances are their circumstances, and to threaten that with improvements in health care or mobility seem absurd. But again, that's part of the box we were in.
My apologies, Madam Chair. Maybe I was ignorant of a little bit of the grandfathering in piece of it. I still have some questions, but I'll save them.
I think that truly, you know, you raised some very valid concerns, Senator Shield, because also along with that is when we talked about building a system of care, and ideally, if you looked at that system of care that Oregon built, it used some of those theories of saying, as much as possible, we keep people in their own home with inside their own family structure and provide them with assistance. And then we say that, you know, if things change, we had developed our adult foster care system. We developed the ALFs. We developed the nursing home as the last piece on this continuum. I think Oregon was, we were very forward thinking when we thought about all of these alternatives, you know, recognizing, you know, my parents, for example, wanted to stay home. And so, you know, we were able to arrange for them to stay home. But not every situation fits those needs. And so I think in Oregon we attempted to build and I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, that we make sure that we keep some structure. And now I would just hate to see us in this funding crisis that we take steps that don't take into consideration the structure and the system that we've built. We may have to do some compressing and we may have to do some tinkering. But I think we were way ahead of the other states when we looked at a truly long-term care system in Oregon and trying to take into consideration the various needs of our elderly population. And that includes being at home so you don't lose your home. That includes, you know, the ALF systems and all the other systems that we try to put in place, Cinder Shields.
My perspective on this is that all of that, and I've been looking at it for 30 years in the ministry, all of that depended on a whole continuum. And what I'm real concerned about is we've kind of cut off the back end of the continuum because of the budget crisis right now. And when you've got a system where we are so concerned about handling the next 2 years, you know, what we're doing with the rest of the continuum, it gets shredded and you know, contorted and so on. And if we ever get out of this woods that we're in, there isn't going to be much of that system left. And that's the problem that I see.
I think that, you know, since we're talking about this on a philosophical basis, and Senator Morris brought up an interesting point about family. You know, we used to be a community or communities where that really was the system. We used to be where we had mom, dad, grandparents, and brothers and sisters and neighbors. Our communities don't have those kind of configurations anymore. I think that sometimes, you know, we're out here trying to build and looking at systems and we look at it from perspective of where we were in our lifetime experiences. And it would be really nice if we still had maybe those kinds of arrangements within inside of our communities. The facts are we don't. We're a very mobile society across this country. You know, young people aren't growing up with their grandparents right next door. We've come up with substitutes ways of dealing with this chronologically advantaged population that we're becoming. And it poses some really, I think, serious debates within our legislative arenas. We're talking about our budget crisis now, but I do think that it poses for us some real discussion of how we're going to deal with the aging population. How are we going to assure that the qualities and some of those things are there? So just kind of throw that out there, Senator Shilson.
Well, thank you for the indulgence in this line of questioning, because it's a big concern, I don't think just to me, but lots and lots of people.
I get concerned the grayer I become.
And I'm right behind you all the way.
Let me go on a little with the service levels, because I think the thing that gets very challenging is you'll see 1 through 17, everyone in there needed some level of assistance. And as I said, what we tried to do with the tool is pair up the critical nature of which are the activities of daily living that are the most critical in comparison also with those that are needing the most levels of assistance. And when you look between 1 and 17, you can probably see some of the differences, although folks at 17 still needed assistance. The examples I've given in the document starting on page 50 are really examples of people who are assessed at levels 9, 10, and 11. They're kind of smack dab in the middle of our assessment world and really are some of the lines that we've had to look at in debating where and how do services and individuals get cut. And I think what you'll recognize is that for each of the persons that is identified here, there is definitely a matter, there is definitely assistance that's required. Some of it may be less intense when you see the words assistance are minimal. It means that someone is present there for the activity but may not need to do the entire activity with the person. But those becomes the very difficult challenge of looking at where and how services are identified in terms of when we look at people who will not receive services based on reduction, there's still a number of people who have quite a bit of assistance. So I thought it would be helpful to just balance those three examples. Once individuals have been determined eligible for services, there are a number of options. And James has referenced in the picture that we look at individuals who are eligible for nursing facilities or licensed community living settings or in-home services. And it's important to note that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services require case managers to offer an eligible person the choice of whether they would look at institutional care of a nursing facility or community care. And then within community care, there's a number of other options of choices. And that has been a very effective options of services that Oregon has used over time. James talked about the hydraulics of balancing the entire system. If you move to page 54 and talking about nursing facilities, what they do is they provide 24-hour comprehensive care, and they're part of the state plan. So they have to be able to be prepared to any person who walks in their door. They have to offer a full package of service. They have to do it for federal reasons, they have to do it for state reasons, and it's a matter of quality of care, and they're able to offer a full array of services. When you get into community living settings, what you can do is hone down a little in terms of what types of support needs does that person need or require. And by the time you get into in-home settings, you really are able to look at those types of services that a family member might offer in conjunction with a paid staff hired by a person needing services. So it's an entire balance of services. I've gone ahead and described, starting on page 55, what licensed community living centers settings do. They always provide a room and board, and then they have some level of care, whether it's medication management, activities with daily living, on-site staff supervision. It's all done in the setting where it's licensed by the state, and they are responsible for both state and federal regulations. They're all part of our home and community-based waivered service. Moving on to what those settings are. There are primarily three types of settings that individuals might opt for within a community program. One would be assisted living facilities. Typically, those are homes where there are six or more people, and they are identified because the person might have their own apartment or with their own kitchen, with their own accessible bathroom. Residential care facilities are six or more people. Again, in those particular settings, there may be more shared rooms, shared bedrooms, shared bathrooms. And then in foster homes, they're licensed homes that are provided to services to five or fewer people. And they're typically in neighborhoods throughout our state. And they have someone, either the foster care provider or residential care manager, on site at all times.
James, could you provide us, as we get into detail, the percentage of individuals who are in assisted living facilities, who are Medicaid, and those who are private pay, and the same as within our residential care facilities and foster homes? I don't want to give this group the understanding that we have 100% in these facilities, because it's driven by both the private pay as well as the Medicaid pay.
Julie may later in talking about this, because I'm talking about those only in Medicaid services. The other option that Oregon has used and has been quite successful in using, and you'll see later in numbers here, is being able to support people in their own homes or homes of their other family members. And that really is where the state dollars become partners with the person and their informal supports, which could be a family member, it could be a community member, a friend, and puts together a package of what are the supports that are required to make sure that person is staying at home and is healthy and safe. It can include services such as a client-employed provider, that's somebody that the person is hiring themselves, and the person takes responsibility for training them, hiring them. We have agencies who will have staff who can act. The agencies take that responsibility. The other kinds of services also can be adult daycare, respite. Many times we have families who provide the bulk of the caregiving, but all they're looking for the state for support is respite for the caregiver from time to time. Home-delivered meals has been an important feature of these programs. Transportation, nursing consultation, and minor home adaptions.
Most of your work is through the client, through the providers. How much of services coming from the community colleges where individuals are in nursing programs? In-home services?
As far as our staff licensed are going through training through community college, is that mm-hmm. your question, Madam Chair? I don't have that answer, but I can find out in terms of how we use that community college.
Madam Chair, how many clients, and this would be an estimate, in your judgment, are capable of self-directed care, making decisions for themselves?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think a number of clients, if they are not making the decision themselves, are having family members that are involved. There is a state guardianship program or guardianship program that we're involved with that you might hear more about on the third day. But I'd say a number of people are really quite able to direct their care and know what they want from a staff person and are pretty clear about what risks they may want to take in terms of whether they want somebody in their home with them all the time or not. Mm-hmm. And it's part of Madam Chair, Senator Morse, it's one of, again, the very critical activities that a case manager has to take on in putting a plan together. One of the things that those case managers will do is they will also have to decide, is this plan going to meet health and safety? And if there is a lot of needs that are listed and there are some care plans that aren't being addressed, they really need to get back and say, would we approve this because this person's only wanting an hour a month or a week of service and really they have much greater needs. They're very interactive with being able to try and look at the best opportunity and the best place for where services should be delivered.
Thank you.
On page 60, what I've done is just list.
I have one question.
Yes, Madam Chair.
What kind of case would require respite?
Respite, Madam Chair, respite is used in a lot of different ways, but an example might be where a spouse is providing the primary care and they are really doing the bulk of supporting someone. What they really need is the ability to get out of the home for 8 hours or 4 hours on a Saturday to do. They use it sometimes for everything from doing grocery shopping to having lunch with a friend. So it's a break for the caregiver for the activities of supporting a person. And that respite is different than what you might see as the in-home staff, which is where staff are coming in to actually do the task of supporting the person, not just to give a break.
I guess I was just looking at what were some of the severe cases where respite is used.
Madam Chair, we can get you some examples
of
how that works. Okay.
On page 60, what I've done is just identified the number of agencies that are providing care. These are agencies that are licensed and around the state. You'll hear later from Cindy Hannum about the licensing of these programs and the numbers of people that are in each of these types of settings. But again, James mentioned earlier the connection between the entire infrastructure of the huge number of providers that are a part of our system and that are critical delivering all of the programs that we've talked about. If you move to page 61, this is really where we demonstrate the impact of where people have been served. And in 0103, including the number of people who are no longer in services. What I've tried to do is identify the numbers by their service priority levels. So, for example, 15 through 17, those are groups of individuals who, as of February 1, services were eliminated to them. 12 through 14, those individuals lost services as of April 1. And going below, their clients who are still in services are individuals who are in service levels 10 through 11 and 1 through 9. But I wanted to show, I think, a couple things. One is the distribution of the numbers of people who are served in their own homes, in licensed community living settings, and nursing facilities. And, of course, as we go into services for people who have greater impairments and greater supervision, you start seeing a shift from the numbers of people in homes to relying on services outside of their own homes.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I have a question, a couple of questions about the top part of the page, the clients who lost long-term services in 0103. What is our follow-up? For example, in the situation of in-home care, what do we know about how those folks are doing now that they've lost services? And the same with the other categories, licensed community, living settings, nursing facilities. Where are these people now? Do we know?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have more anecdotal information than we have real data. And let me explain a little bit about what happened in the process as people were being eliminated from services and where our communities are to date. First, as individuals were given notices, case managers were working with individuals and really looking at identifying, putting together pieces of replacement of services. None were able to really put together the full level of long-term care services that they lost, but they might work with an individual to identify anyone who might be available to them who hadn't been part of that circle before. So it could be a family member or a neighbor. They could be eligible, if they were still eligible, for Medicaid to get some personal care hours, and no more than 20 hours a month. Still not anywhere near the level of assistance or supports they were receiving prior to being out of system. The follow-up, there are a couple counties who are independently taking actions and doing some follow-up, and you probably will hear more in testimony from advocates about what they are finding in terms of where people are. But once people have been eliminated from these services, one of the things that they also are eliminated for is case management if they had been in long-term care and they're not eligible for Medicaid as well. So we don't have the type of data or response that can tell us exactly where people are. We've been concerned. We do have information where people have told us about individuals who have ended up in a hospital, who didn't end up taking their medication and or may have had a fall due to lack of support and had reentered the system. But we don't have the ability to look at person by person where they are and how that's been managed.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say that don't have the ability, does that mean that you don't have the staff capacity to do the follow-up? Is that what
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes. The case management staff, again, as we've gone through reductions, we look at reducing the entire system, and the ability to provide case management to services not eligible for services, we have not had resources to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe you said that there are two counties doing some independent follow-up. Which are those counties?
I believe Washington County has told us that they have been doing some follow-up and calling individuals. And in Southern Oregon, Rogue Valley, down in the Jackson County area, has told us that they, too, are doing some follow-up. And, again, it may be more anecdotal stories that they're collecting. They've found that many people are not incredibly receptive to hearing from them at the moment. So they are trying to do some of the follow-up, but again, it represents only a small part of the state.
Thank you. I would just add that I'm just stating the obvious here. It's really troubling that we are not doing the follow-up with people who are, you know, clearly been placed in a vulnerable situation. When I look at the numbers, just taking the licensed community living setting category, when I look at those numbers on the face of it, at least from where I'm sitting, those are not large numbers. So I'm wondering what capacity of staff would it take to do follow-up, you know, just a phone call. And then after that, you know, face-to-face would be another step. But how much capacity could it possibly take to follow up with that number of people?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we'll go back and take a look and come back and tell you how we can do that. A number of the people are still are on case management, and again, I can get you further data in terms of those individuals who are still under Medicaid and may be receiving small numbers of care under a program called Personal Care, which is about 20 hours a month of service. Mm-hmm. And so for that group, we should know, again, where how they are faring with the reduced amount of services since they're still in our system.
And I don't want to stop there, Madam Chair. I would like to have the same information for the nursing facility category. I just think we have a responsibility to have an answer to that question.
And the bigger question, because I know that the agency, when we were going through the crisis, that several things was taking place, that the casework staff was trying to, in some cases, reestablish eligibility into different categories, and whether those categories were picked up someplace else in the system, so that even though you're saying you lost within those categories, did they show up in, let's say, levels 10 and 11? And I know that that was taking place. That's the reason I asked the question earlier, how much was being reassessed and that the levels were actually changed. And then the other issue is how many of them ended up in other programmatic areas, whether it was 20 hours in-home, but some of those. And then I think it would be helpful to know that how many was just actually eliminated from the system, period, totally, and then what's the outcome of those. Because if some of them remained, as I worked with the ombudsman, Jen Dennison, not the long-term care, but the other one in the agency, there was an intensive work that was going on inside the agency to assure that individuals would receive some services and that they would be totally dropped. So it would be helpful if we knew what those outcomes were.
Madam Chair, we can get you those numbers. I think the numbers you see here in levels 12 through 17, though, are the actual numbers of people that were terminated. When we started, when we originally gave notice, they were larger than that, and so some of the people through the reassessment process then have shifted to the bottom chart to still be eligible in those levels. But we can distinguish those for you.
It would be helpful if we knew the total universe and what happened with the cuts. And, you know, those who, if we had X population, those who we were able to absorb in the system through reevaluation or, you know, what happened to those, and those remaining, and, you know, some idea, particularly those, the nursing home facilities should be easy to track. I would think about 193 of those. But just give us some sense of what's happening with those individuals. Mm-hmm. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. Is it possible for you to provide the names and addresses of individuals, for example, in my district? Is that a protected HIPAA type?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think it is. I mean, I'm sure we could give you numbers.
I'm interested in numbers. But if I wanted to call on people in my district to do a personal assessment, is that possible?
They would have to, but I think you're then giving in some confidentiality issues. Okay. Unless the person themselves gave you authorization to do that, the agency can on its own action, and I'm seeing some heads bobbing, I'm going back to the days when I was there, they cannot do that.
They're no longer in the program.
doesn't matter. It's the same as if you were in the program and your identity and who you are and the services that you receive is bound by confidentiality standards. It's for your protection as the individual. And unless the person within your communities grant you the right to do so, then I think the agency can.
Thank you.
Well, I think this is a good way for us to end before we start into eligibility. And I will see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah, you can. Awesome.